Yeah, well, that's my position, really, is that although I also feel concerned and distressed for what I would say is now open organized child abuse as opposed to covert, albeit in different ways. I imagine the other kind is still going on, but that is distressing in and of itself. But I mean, I've been looking at that and talking about that for years, and well, I know that that's something that most people are not really going to want to know or think about, even or especially if they themselves were victims of it. So that I accept. But in terms of what's happening with the trans thing, it's this collective gaslighting, you could call it. It seems to me that even independently of the harm that's being inflicted on children, it's inflicting harm on all of us by forcing us to actually go along with things that either we know are untrue, or at best we simply haven't understood. We haven't even tried to understand enough to know whether they're true or not. So starting from this whole premise of gender itself, I mean, that's there's actually no basis for it, really. But now it's actually this supposedly established empirical reality of something that exists independently of the body. And I think, you know, I think there's I think it is so much more far-reaching than we suspect in terms of a condition as well, and mind the, you know, the language modification and the crazy making of it. Obviously that's far-reaching, but in terms of actually what's being misidentified, which is body dysphoria, I would say that that's probably almost universal in the West. Like, who of us really feels at home in our bodies? Who of us wouldn't like to somehow, you know, find peace in our bodies if we knew which buttons to push, and, you know, could yeah. somehow magic a solution, like waving the magical wand in fairy tales, essentially.
I sometimes wonder if some of the older men, because it does seem to be a thing of men in their sort of mid-50s, I wonder if they could afford a Ferrari, whether or not they'd start wearing skirts outside. Like there's a chap at the local train station who, I mean, he's a cross between Friar Tuck and a 1980s hooker from the television, to be fair. But he's in a women's uniform, and the fact that these people are not satisfied with feeling something and wearing, you know, a lot of women wear jeans and a t-shirt and flat shoes, but this guy's not satisfied with that. He doesn't want to be like his female colleague who wears trousers and a shirt. He wants everybody to know and work and sort of treat him like he's a woman. And so he wears the women's uniform. He's just started socially transitioning. So I don't know. I mean, in this country, I'm wondering if the government have done it as a bit of virtue signalling, but also they can get away with then the NHS no longer having to treat these people if it's no longer a medical condition. You know, counselling is expensive, and hormone blockers and hormones and cross-sex hormones and all these things, you know, will these people be able to get that on the NHS? But it's what's weird as well is it's so celebrated. You know, in some schools they have like a transition assembly for kids,
right?
So it's proper. These children become tyrants in their own classrooms because they get to demand the teacher says a certain pronoun. They get to use toilets maybe they shouldn't use in changing rooms, which actually still by law in this country is illegal, but nobody seems to recognise that. So from the age of 8 in public spaces, you have to provide female and male toileting and washing facilities. It's in our equality law that, you know, basically girls have to have this space. And I've phoned an organisation who talks to schools called Educate and Celebrate. And they go and advise schools about things. And they wrote to me, because I pretended to be a governor, and they said, oh, yeah, by law, you have to have gender-neutral toilets. So I phoned them and had this long chat. And this woman said, oh, yeah, gender-neutral toilets. And I said, well, I thought, according to my guidance, that you have to have a separate sex facility from the age of 8. And she said, do you mean gender? And I said, no, I mean sex. She was, I don't get it. What's sex got to do with going to the toilet? And I said, well, if you are a girl, you will have a period. If you think you're a girl, you probably won't have one. I said, so it's very different. It's quite embarrassing. If you had to go to the toilet next to a man or a boy and you've got to unwrap a tampon, then that's really loud and noisy and you're going to feel deeply embarrassed, which is why we allow private spaces for girls. And she said, yeah, I don't really know why that would be a problem. And this person's advising schools. So she said that what I could do, because I said that the school wouldn't have budgets to change all our toilets, she said, well, you can just take the disabled toilet. And I said, don't I have to provide that for my pupils then, my pupils with disabilities? Don't they have to have as quick access to that toilet as possible? And she said, no, it's fine. So I could, yeah. So these disabled children in wheelchairs, they can sod off, because if they think, if they're cis, if they're whatever sex they were born, then they're far less important than the girl who wants to wear a boy's uniform.
Yeah, so that's just, it seems that what you're describing there is proof of Orwell's principle of doublethink. I mean, the point of doublethink is to prevent people from being able to think, right? Because every time they have a thought, the opposite thought rises up and, cancels it out, and so they just can't carry on thinking about it. So that sounds like that conversation. You're basically presenting certain facts around the situation to this person that prevent her, because they each one invokes a corresponding, counter thought that basically says, no, you can't think about this. So the only answer is, oh, that's not a problem. That's fine. It's fine. Yeah, they can use the disabled. Oh, well, the disabled can use the gender. Oh, well, they just keep passing the buck.
But they I mean, it's like we've had, there was a bit of a campaign for this poor trans woman prisoner to get into women's prisons, and he was going on hunger strike. And there was a really sympathetic article in The Guardian. And what they failed to mention is he had a catalogue of 64 crimes against women and girls. And he would basically break into houses and try on their underwear and masturbate, sometimes with them in the house. But that wasn't mentioned. And still, we had to feel sympathy for this person's identity over and above the fact that he was a disgusting, vile sex criminal. And I think what that means is if you take that person away and say, or it'll be the Schroeder's trans, like that person's not really trans. And you're like, well, it's a bit like the jihadi terrorists. Well, they're not really a Muslim. And you're like, well, when do we do that to people then? Like, it's okay to self-identify to get in a toilet, but if you self-ID to get in a toilet and then you committed a crime, you no longer whatever you self-ID'd. You can't have it both ways. You either have to accept that there are going to be some pretty disgusting, evil trans women, because according to research I've done into the trans inmate study of California, or it might be Texas, but I think it's California 2008, 2009, which is quite lefty, and it's all for the safety and the it's pro-trans basically. But even they talk about the fact that there is no change in the criminality of someone post-transition. So it's so trans women commit crime, weirdly and coincidentally, at the same rate as all other men. So it's but they'll just do this thing of saying, well, they're not trans, or that person, I think I've criticized people like that before, like that criminal, and I'll have criticized them, and people will tell me off for misgendering the sex.
Right. Yeah, well, again, that's the no thinking thinking process, and it's the same with desistance, like the trans people who desist, as in they change their mind and try and go back or do go back. They're, by definition, they weren't real trans either, so they don't count. Those statistics don't count.
Yeah.
So it's a constantly moving target. There's no way to really. I mean, but that's it. I mean, if you banish logical, rational argument and scientific method and evidence and data from the discussion, then you've essentially won the discussion.
Well, they shut it down. They don't even participate. They won't enter. They won't do debates.
Well, I know. So then there's that. They won't even, I mean, because they can't without appearing utterly insane. I shouldn't say they, because then you get into these muddy waters. But if, yeah, from that position, which basically says it's all just what I feel, and that's it, that's the only thing to talk about here. Well, if every time they respond to the facts, they just say, well, I don't feel that way, obviously, then there isn't, it just appears ridiculous, which it is. So then, in order to, shut down that, it's simply that there should be no platforming, no debate, because it's all driven by a phobic, hateful, intolerant mindset.
Well, the ones that do debate as well don't operate in the normal rules of engagement in debate. They'll just sit next to someone who says something and they'll call them a liar, or they'll say that's nonsense and you're talking nonsense, and then they'll say something completely unrelated. But it's and actually, I don't think that's just a trans thing. I think that's a left thing. I mean, I'm very much left the left now. I have no tolerance for it. I think some people would call it red-pilled, but I think once I can be viewed as a hateful bigot who wishes children to commit suicide just for questioning the trans narrative, then I don't really trust anything that I've been led to believe over the last, well, my entire adult life. But I can't really put my finger on anything that I know to be true, because most of the things are things that I'm supposed to think. So it's been a massive awakening for me, and not entirely comfortable, and it's just peculiar that I've become, people will say you're right wing, and I'm like, I'm not right, I'm definitely not right wing, but I'm actually finding myself listening to people on the right, because they seem to want to engage in debate. Whereas I think the left, there's so many things you can't say on the left. Like Miriam Nemazi is a woman I follow, she's an ex-Muslim. And she gave a talk at Goldsmiths against somebody who believed in stoning women to death for adultery. And Miriam Nemazi speaks out against Islam. And she was given a trigger warning before her speech. Whereas the guy that believes in stoning a woman to death, he wasn't.
Right.
And it's really interesting where we're going, and I don't know what's going to stop it really. But I think it's cyclical, isn't it? This 80 years of the left go a bit too far, and then the right come down with a big hard stamping
Yeah,
of
yeah.
course.
This is the pendulum effect, I call it. And I think it's designed, this is why I say we probably don't have time to get into it, but it's a book that I've written that's coming out next year, actually, that's about, because I grew up in the leftist environment, as I said, with these Champagne Socialist Labour supporters. My grandfather was a founding member of the CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. They seemed like very virtuous people. They weren't. They were alcoholics and worse, I would say, unfortunately. But they knew all the right signals, and they knew all. They were. It was very near the beginning of. Well, perhaps not the beginning, but when it was becoming really socially visible, these programs and agendas, the welfare state and so on and so forth, that have now, taken over in Britain and have taken us to the point that we've reached. In my research, I was able to trace the ideology back because my grandfather was a member of the Fabian Society, I hadn't known that when I was growing up, but I found it out just recently while researching. I'm like, oh, well, I've heard of those guys. I better look into what they were about. Turns out the Fabian Society were not just one of the first socialist organizations. Of course, they created the Labour Party, but they were also heavily into sexual research and crowd psychology and social engineering. I mean, they were social engineering, but they studied, and the Tavistock was one of the sort of shoot-off organizations. And so Havelock Ellis was a founding Fabian, and he was the person who coined the term homosexual. He was one of the early researchers into transgender and so on and so forth. And so it's kind of a it's possible to map agendas that have been promoting these ideas and these values over a very long period of time. This is what Fabianism is about. It's about incremental change. If you want to bring about profound change in a society, you've got to work very, very slowly and very, very incrementally, but based on principles that are kind of universal. So, and one of those principles, I think, is what you were just referring to, which is I haven't heard about the 80-year cycle, but the pendulum effect, which is if you push very libertarian, leftist programs and agendas for long enough, eventually, because people need boundaries, they need structure. You can see this in a family or in a human psyche as well. It's that Weimar Republic syndrome. If there's too much freedom, something in an individual and in a collective and in a society panics at a certain point because it can't bear it, can't stand it. It's so destabilizing. And then there's a corresponding counter reaction, and then you have the opposite. You have this massive totalitarian, imposition of structure. So you can see that the two, what seem like two agendas or two programs or even two ideologies, if you go up a level and see the context, the psychosocial context for them, then it's not, it's a single agenda that uses apparently opposing ideologies to attain its ends.
Right. I guess that makes,
And that's one of my concerns, writing and talking about transgender, is that my sense is that, well, I mean, to use a really sort of stark example, I mean, one of the things the Fabians were all in favor on, just in favor of, along with the Nazis, they weren't affiliated with the Nazis, but they're both socialists, was eugenics.
Yes.
And of course, what's going on with the trans movement is, you could say it's a eugenics movement
Yeah.
also, because they're sterilizing anyone who's kind of anomalous and has gender identity confusion. Well, this is what's being prescribed for them, is sterilization. So, well, coincidence? I don't know. Maybe it isn't a coincidence. Maybe what's driving a lot of the pro-trans stuff is the same old, well, I mean, what's been called homophobia, and I think that's bullshit too, because
Okay.
it's just another label and a buzzword that's distorting the reality. But I mean, you talk about misogyny. Well, there's a deep, profound fear of women that's in our society, insofar as it's patriarchal. It's in the male psyche because of things I touched on in terms of mother enmeshment, men who can't ever fully get individuated from their mother's psyche. There's a lot of unresolved issues, mother issues there, and that's a reality. That's, unfortunately, we're not allowed to talk about those realities because psychology is becoming, it's one of the first casualties in the, on the on the ideological battleground. But I
But there
think,
is
yeah.
homophobia in the movement. It's just not the homophobia of hating trans. I think there are people that are probably homophobic that would like to beat the crap out of a trans woman. I think there are men that find the idea of men not fitting in as men, they probably find that very, very difficult and causes them to be violent. I mean, maybe it raises loads of issues for themselves.
Yeah.
But I think there's an overriding homophobia in deciding that it's better to be trans than to be gay,
Sure.
especially for lesbian girls, but also for really effeminate boys. And I think I've heard in the homosexual kind of culture in itself, being an effeminate male is just not, it's you're the lowest of the low if you're a camp gay man. So I think there's a somebody called Munro Bergdorf over here who had a programme made about him called What Makes a Woman? And one of my speeches was actually used in it. But he's a really effeminate black guy. And I can't help thinking that he just couldn't be a homosexual black guy. So he'd rather be a trans woman.
Right.
And he's been in, I mean, he's been in Playboy. He's still got his penis. So it's covered in a pose. But, you know, he was in Playboy as a centerfold or whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, I know there is that what you just zeroed in on. It's definitely becoming manifest just recently with the lesbian protest at the gay march thing. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that the trans movement is now, in a sense, turning on its own and ostracizing the the previous select sort of minority group, right? But I think it seems as though there's, I don't know if we could put it down to homophobia per se, because there was a period in when the effeminate man wasn't vilified, like Quentin Crisp, my brother. He wasn't actually gay, but he certainly made a career out of being a camp sort of dandy guy. There definitely was a period, and it wasn't that long ago, where being gay was high status. And I mean, it still is to some extent. You watch TV shows, my God, I mean, there's just so much virtue signaling about the gay characters and this, that, and the other. But it's, and I find that offensive. Like, I'm not a right-wing Christian bigot or any of those things, but unfortunately, I am to some people, or I will be, because I don't think homosexuality is as simple or cut and dried as we've been indoctrinated to believe it is. Maybe some of the time it's genetic, but some of the time it's symptomatic. It's symptoms of child abuse. That's the data supports that. So far, I don't like to rely on data, but let's say it's unresolved. Like that, I'm pretty sure there are cases of men who have opted to be homosexual as a way of coping with abuse and mother issues and so on and so forth. And so it's not, strictly speaking, genetic, and maybe they might benefit from psychotherapy, but of course that's absolutely unsayable now. I'm going to say it because I'm sick and tired of having to censor myself. But anyway, it was part of a larger point, which is that it seems as though the minority that's getting raised up and singled out as special, it keeps sort of mutating and changing, and when that does happen, then the previous minority that was singled out, of course, has to then become it's like succession drama, really, like a
Well,
identity politics succession drama.
no one's telling gay men that they must have sex with trans men with vaginas. It's only people telling lesbians that they are bigoted for not considering having sex with a penis.
That's true, but it certainly could get to that. I mean, I've certainly heard about, let's see, it would be a man who's surgically altered to be a woman, or now even hasn't, but who identifies as a woman. If they want to have sex with a man, and the man says, "Sorry, I'm not homosexual," or "I don't want to have sex with a trans woman," that could be homophobia, right? So it could happen, even if it hasn't, snowballed into a visible phenomenon.
Well, recently, I think somebody found so two boys in America hit on a trans girl, so a boy. And when they found out this person wasn't a girl, I think they beat him to death. I think they beat him up. And loads of my friends are like, "That's really homophobic." And I said, "But I don't know. I don't think it is homophobic." That if you think you're about to have sex with somebody and then they've got the wrong genitals, then I don't think that is homophobic. I think that's the same for all of us, isn't it? You know, if I'm a straight woman, so I would expect somebody, I mean, I've been happily married for a long time, but I would expect somebody that I had an interest in to have a penis. And I would expect my husband to, you know, want somebody with a vagina. I don't really, it's the everything's quite muddled. It's like nobody's allowed any boundaries anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It's the eradication of boundaries, and it's a compensatory reaction to, overly rigid and overly oppressive boundaries. The past is back to the pendulum effect. But it, yeah, I mean it. like I for me it does come back to the body. I always want to bring it back to the body. Are you aware of the how transgender is I guess we'd say it's a gateway, is the phrase now. It's a gateway to the transhumanism. Are you aware of that aspect?
I have heard one of my friends is well versed in it, yes.
Yeah. So I just watched a documentary, or not a documentary, it was a presentation yesterday by, of course, now I won't remember the name and I'll be annoyed, but I think Martine was the woman. I'll find it while we're talking. And she did a he. Self-identified as she, Martine Rothblatt, did a presentation on transgender, making distinction between technological trans and non, as in those who've actually had all the surgery and the rest of it, and those who haven't. And then, as a lead-in for transhumanism, which is people who, not that they feel that they've been born in the wrong body, but that they shouldn't have been born in a body at all.
It's just so, it's just proper bonkers nuts, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, if that's not a pathology, then I think the bar no longer exists, right? It's like there's no bar at all. Yeah, you could just say anything, and you just mustn't pathologize it as long as it doesn't harm anyone else. And that, but this is a false. I think it's a false distinction, because what we do to ourselves does affect other people,
Well, it's
inevitably.
when you demand that those people collude in whatever you decide for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone wants to sit at home and watch porn all day, although I think porn harms people because the people participate in it and the whole industry is disgusting. But if you want to sit at home then in a dress and pleasure yourself morning, noon, and night, and you can pay your bills and you're not going to piss off your neighbours, pardon my language, but you're not going to annoy anyone, then go for it.
I suppose, but even there, they've got, unless they're never going to see anyone again, you know, still they have family, they have people that interact with them. I mean, it seems to me that whole privatization of morality is the thin end of the wedge that we're now, you know, stumbling over, essentially, because people aren't islands. We're not actually separate. That's what we want. Yeah, we want to be able to sit at home and jack off at porn all day, to porn all day. I mean, some part of us wants something, the equivalent of that, like the closest we can get to not having a body, really, and not having any relations, just pleasure, 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 like a rat in a cage. But it's a self-destructive lifestyle, and I know that affects others, because I grew up in a self-destructive family, and just because it didn't kill me doesn't mean it made me stronger.
No. But we've been heading towards this for ages, haven't we? Like, if I tomorrow want to go and buy a new car, as long as I've got decent credit rating, I can just go and have a new car. Or if I download something from the internet, it's got to be in seconds. We're in a really, there's no hard work, there's no kind of ethic of hard work and reward. Going back to my son cheering somebody on, and everything's too easy. And we expect it to be easy, and I don't think as humans we can survive on that. I think actually we've evolved way back, before we made our lives so easy. We evolved that we actually had to work our asses off to make sure that we could eat. And now everything is easy, and I think that's the problem with these children, and these young people who are transitioning, not the old. And I'm just going to say it, the old pervy men, I think, is very, very different. I think they're common ground transsexuals, and I think they just have a really extreme fetish. But the young people doing it, I think we've got to the point where there's no one in living memory that really remembers living through a war. And so they live in this sort of luxurious safety that nothing bad is going to happen. So the only problems they can focus on are those they manifest themselves about their own person.
Well, although I make a qualifier there with manifest, I mean, because it's presumably there's latent issues that get magnified by too much self indulgence, really. 'Cause it's not self-examination, really. I mean, it's not. I think it's narcissism, essentially, like a runaway narcissism in a narcissistic culture can only create narcissists. And If you're just gazing at your reflection all day long, yeah, you're going to be seeing all the imperfections and feeling miserable about it and wanting to perfect that image.
I do agree with you with the narcissism. I think it's overwhelming. And I also think a lot of the trans women I've met absolutely hate women with a tangible, it's tangible how much they hate women. And I compare it to the time that my family and I, as in my husband and our kids, flew to Thailand on Christmas Day one year because my parents lived in mainland China and we thought we'd go to Thailand for New Year. And I was on that plane and I was one of the only females on the plane because it was predominantly men on their own going out to the sex capital of the world. And that was a tangible, that was a kind of to my husband, do not bloody go to sleep. We have to stay awake the whole time. Don't let any of the children, don't let anyone look at the children. There was just, you can feel that sort of thing. And I felt that I was supposed to participate in a program called Gender Quake, which Caitlyn Jenner was on, and I actually had a couple of glasses of wine with Jermaine Greer, who was also on it. But in the room also were these 6 foot trans women, and it was peculiar. They had the same cheekbones because they all go to the same sort of fillers on their cheekbones and the There was a kind of there was. I tell you how it felt, and I'm not a vain woman, but I'm not. I think I'm all right. But there was definitely a feeling in that room of these men thought they were better women than I was. And they'd achieved because for them, a woman is literally how you look, or if you cry at an advert. All the stereotypes that we talk about women that's portrayed on the television that isn't really how most of us live. But there was definitely this arrogance that they were better at being women than I was.
It makes me wonder if they're if the extreme sensitivity and reactivity of some of these self-identified men, women, is their attempt to imitate what they think women are like, as in being really emotionally reactive.
Yeah, I think also some of them are taking a shed load of hormones.
Right, that would destabilize, huh?
I've seen it when, well, they do a lot of this mimicry. So they'll reference stuff that you think that isn't anything to do with womanhood. They'll talk about, I'm definitely like a woman because. My friends say I'm really sensitive, and I think, well, I'm really not sensitive, and I'm still a woman. I barely things. I'm really thick-skinned. You have to be quite. I will stand my ground, but you have to be quite offensive to offend me. There's really nothing that many people could say that would get to me at all. So I'm not sensitive. I'm not particularly tactile. My husband, who's really blokey, is far more tactile with our children than I am, and a lot softer with them than I am. So I'm not really ticking, but then I will wear a face full of makeup every time I leave my house, and I do dress really feminine, and I have long nails, and so loads about me outwardly, I guess, are quite feminine, but I've got quite a mathematical, logical brain, which apparently is not a feminine thing. Which is obviously bollocks because I am pretty much very much, I'm very much a woman.
Morning birds screamed all night. If there was just a little light left, something to grow into panic. You, I but I take this lying down. Justified sin, you know it'd be a justified sin, you know it'd be clean. You know it'd be purifying, you know it'd be purifying, you know it'd be. A little fright left, something to grow into panic.
Because you can't reduce being one sex or another to just the sum of the parts of characteristics and qualities. So it's almost as if there is some ineffable something about being one sex or another. I don't know if that's true or not, but it just struck me as a kind of ironic, because that's all that this argument has to rest on, is the proposing of an ineffable something that makes this person a woman and not, or as much a woman as somebody who's born a woman, right? But it seems, as far as I can gauge, and this is in the transhuman thing, the ineffable something isn't really that ineffable at all, except unless you're talking scientifically. It's just their opinions and their feelings and their preferences, and basically it's the ego, far as I can see. And that's the transhuman thing, which is they call it the beeman. those who want to actually just become a beeman, which is beyond human now. It's not just that they don't want to be male or female, they don't want to be human anymore, they want to be beeman. And a beeman is the collection of, or the amalgamation of, it's like your Facebook profile essentially, but as an actual package of information that gets uploaded into the cloud, basically all your preferences, all your feelings, your memories, your associations, your likes and your dislikes, your beliefs, right?
I don't even know where to start with such nonsense. It's just that, for most of us, and for most of the world who live in poverty, they don't have the luxury of this shit, do they? No. Let's face it. They're struggling every day to make sure they've got enough to eat. I think I've read in war zones and in times and spells of absolute survival mode, so if there's been an earthquake or whatever, the propensity of people to suffer from depression or eating disorders or anything like that goes down almost to nothing.
Mm.
Because they don't have the luxury of having these kind of things going on. They're too busy worrying about living.
or even just engaged in it. I mean, it doesn't have to be intense hardship, I don't think, to provide kind of meaning and purpose to our lives. It can just be that we're fully engaged with practical, meaningful problems rather than how to polish our narcissistic identity and make it shine, which is not a healthy, I don't see it as a healthy pastime for anyone, much less a pursuit, but it is, I mean, it's hard to avoid that because we have a culture that promotes that. Of course, it's called the pursuit of happiness, ironically. At any cost, it would seem now.
It's so weird. I think I did look on your blog, and I see that you've got a few pictures of Jordan Peterson, and what I find interesting about some of his ideas in this is that nobody's looking for a long-term solution to their happiness. They're looking for short-term all the time. It's what will make me happy for the next 5 minutes, as opposed to
Yeah.
what really fulfills you in your life is not, it's like the lottery winners, isn't it? They win everything. They win more money than they ever thought they'd ever have. And loads of them end up depressed, unhappy, and divorced. Because they haven't worked for it. It's just all of it. I think everything's too easy. And therefore, nothing has value.
Well, one of the, I think one of the opening statements of this Martine trans human person was avoid suffering. Like that's the goal, the mission statement, or what have you. Avoid suffering, and I'd say that that's what you're talking about there. And in terms of pursuing happiness, in quotes, in terms of instant gratification, it's not really about finding happiness or even pleasure. It's about avoiding suffering. Like whatever we have to do to avoid suffering. And the long-term losses of that are incalculable, I think, because suffering, well, A, it's unavoidable, for God's sake, wake up, hello. But B, I mean, I don't want to get old-fashioned, use terms like character building, but I mean, it does provide an opportunity to for acceptance. As in, we're in situations we can't actually control. We have to grow up a bit. We have to let go of our own agendas and just accept things as they are and work with it and compromise. And it's called living, so I think that that's the thing that's snowballing here.
But if you avoid all suffering, then surely you avoid all joy, because at the end of all joy is an end to that joy. So I've been with my husband for 20 years this year, and I love him dearly, but there's always that risk that, maybe in 5 years he won't be he'll die. But without being this happy and joyful and working damn hard at a relationship, because they're not that easy. But without that, without this immense joy, there would be no risk of the suffering that I will endure or he may endure should one of us die. So I don't really see how you can have a fulfilling life without
Yeah, that's true.
risk.
So that's the goal, is to ensure that your satisfaction and your happiness comes only from things you can control.
Which is what I mean. I don't. Is there anything
No.
that you?
Well, unless you believe in the transhumanist dream, which I think you have to be insane to believe in it, but
Really? Isn't it? It's just. I don't know. It's. We're just all about this gratification. It's. Well, I'm raising my kids so that they can fit into a society which will make them happy. So I went to this meeting after the warning letter from the school, and I was very cross. And somebody said, "Oh, but you're all about the free speech, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, not for kids, not for children. You earn your right. You earn your right for free speech. The idea is that you become a citizen of our society, and then you can have your opinions and self-expression, but you have to learn to kind of fit in first, otherwise you're doomed. If schools and parents don't discipline these children, out of love and compassion, then there's a whole world out there that will do it without any love or compassion. They will just hate your kids.
Yeah.
And they'll be unlikable. But it's, oh, I don't even know where I'm going with this, but I just don't get it. And I'm not even that earnest or hardworking myself. You know, but this, and I'm not religious, so I'm an anti-theist, so I've never, ever, ever had a belief in God. I wasn't raised with any religion whatsoever. So I don't have that to rely on or fall back on as a structural or moral compass.
Mm.
I just have to believe that actually what I do in this world is, I don't know, get through every day, raise some nice kids.
So I wasn't raised with a religion either, but as I say, I was raised in an ideological framework that I certainly rejected and I consider unhealthy, and I don't know if it was a side effect of that or what, but certainly by the time I was in my early 20s, I was completely convinced that the society we lived in was wholly destructive, wholly, you know, negative. Like I don't think I've ever had a positive view about society. I don't have kids. I've got a niece. I'm concerned for her, the way that the world is going. But I just wonder for yourself, like it sounds as though you've had quite a steep curve in terms of, did you feel, is it a relatively new thing for you to feel like that you're living and raising your children in a society that is, whatever word you would call, what use for it, I don't want to put my words. How would you describe the society in Britain right now in a couple of words?
Illiberal liberalism. Totalitarian.
Okay. Totalitarian liberalism, yeah.
It's, yeah, it's kind of, you will live and let live, and if you don't, I'm going to
kill you. Yeah.
Really? But my kids have, what's different, so I've got 16, so I've got three boys, they're 16, 15 and 9, and then I have a daughter of 11, and they're all, we talk about stuff, and I'm a feminist, and although I don't, I'm losing that label, I feel more and more distant from that label, because I feel that is part of identity politics that I don't want to be part of.
Mm.
I want to have my principles, and I want to believe that women should be able to choose to do things, but I also am a stay-at-home mother, and I've chosen to do that, and I don't have a traditional marriage, but my husband goes out to work, and we're both adults, you know, irrespective of our sex, we're both adults who both work for the good of our family, so I probably don't do enough housework, to be fair, to really balance the books, but you know, my kids have the difficulty of probably being the kids that are not going to think that trans women are women when everybody else will freely say it. The school near me, so I live in Wiltshire, and I live near a village called Bradford-on-Avon, and they have a deputy head who transitioned, and he's nearly 60, and then the kids have to call him Miss James. And it actually is the best school in the area, but I cannot send my children there because I cannot have them having to say to somebody in a position of authority that they think that they're the sex that everyone knows they're not. Mm. And I've heard a rumour, and I think a rumour is enough to be coercive. I've heard a rumour that somebody got a detention for calling him Mister.
Mm.
Now, I find that wholly just quite revolting. I just think, why couldn't he have waited? If he was so desperate to wear women's clothes, why not retire early or do it at the weekends? Why did he need to take that into school? You know. But my son has already been called transphobic at his school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've sort of said to them, it's not their hill to die on, and if what I think they should do is probably keep quiet, because it's not, you know.
Except that it's not enough to keep quiet because you have to say the right things, if you know what I mean. It's not just enough not to say the wrong things. They want you to say what they consider the right things.
Right? Yeah, they do. So they'll say, you know that let Levi now, or whatever the child's name is, you know that they are a boy. And so then my son will have to say, no, she's not.
Or at least, no, I don't know. I mean, that, and that's probably bad enough, right? If you say, well, no, I don't know, because show me the evidence. And they don't have any evidence. There is no evidence. Back to this thing, you know, when you're being made to not just say, but believe something that without having been given any evidence for it, then you, the only way to go along with that is you have to shut down your own rational faculties. Or say, well, it doesn't matter, I'll just say anything to get along. But I think that's also kind of self-harming in a way.
Well, the cognitive dissonance is this horrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, just all of it. I mean, I refuse to do it on any level, at any moment, for anyone. But I have no career to lose. I have no job or money to lose. I have no friendship circle to lose because my friends are either in Bristol. I moved to Wiltshire about 3 years ago, so I haven't really established any friends here because I do live in a very bizarre place. But also, you know, there is no risk and I have everything to gain because, I want to protect my boys too because I think it's important that they are protected, but I think the person most at risk out of my family of six is my daughter from this ideology. And I think that could be a boy in her changing room or a man in her changing room. You know, and it's a risky thing. And I think probably more than ever before, and going back to your question about my kids, more than ever before, I'm fearful for them in this society because they're older, so they're just upon this society. You know, in 2 years my oldest will be 18.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact we went somewhere recently and he had a suit fitting for his prom, and the person who served him was definitely a trans man with a very, very thick beard, hands not much bigger than mine. I've got really small hands, so hands not much bigger than mine, not much taller than me, probably about 5'2". I'm just going to say this. This is not a nice thing to say. I'm going to say it anyway. I have yet to see a female to male who would have had an easy time being a female, who would have been like the prettiest girl in the room, because they're just not. Because I think if you have that currency of being attractive to the opposite sex, and you like the opposite sex, I don't think transitioning is something that you would do. But that's just me being me, I expect.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's terribly radical. It's clear it is dysphoria, and, you know, even in the official designation, we're talking about dysphoria, which is unhappiness. So, I think there's a widespread racket now which has very deep ideological roots, which are much more sinister, in my opinion, than pure, you know, financial exploitation. But to provide snake oil to unhappy people who will just reach out for seeming cures because they haven't been provided with the tools to develop discernment to say no.
Yeah. But we've been heading here for a long time, with or without the trans stuff. We've been heading to, I've watched an Adam Curtis documentary about America and about how nearly this whole town were on antidepressants.
Mm.
And rather than solve whatever it is that's making you feel damn miserable, you just pop a pill. When I was at university, I went to the GP, excuse me, GP, and said I wasn't feeling very happy. I was a bit homesick, and I really wanted him to prescribe some counselling. And I don't even think I was that unhappy. And I left that doctor's office with Prozac.
Mm-hmm.
Prescription for Prozac. I never took it because I'd never take antidepressants because I haven't needed them. But it was just quite funny that he spent less than 5 minutes with me and thought it was okay to prescribe some antidepressants.
Right. There's a writer, I don't know if you know him, he's called Theodore Dalrymple. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Yeah, he's a conservative writer. He's a very good writer and he's a very, very sane chap, very likeable. He was on this podcast and he was a doctor, a prison doctor and a psychiatrist for, I don't know how long, 30 years or so. And so a lot of his writing is about that, and it's all based in his experience of that. And one of the first things I read by him was about this, about how, of all the people, you know, he consulted with them, they all, the ones that were suffering from, you know, emotional distress, they all referred to themselves as depressed, and not one of them referred to themselves as unhappy. And the reason, as he understood it, this had been encouraged in the culture, and that they'd gone along with the cues, was because if you talk about depression, then basically you're self-diagnosing, and it corresponds with a diagnosis that you will get, and then you can be medically treated. Of course, I mean, that there's that we're talking about, as in there's just some external mechanistic solution. But the point he was making was that unhappiness was kind of intuitively understood to relate to our own behavior and lifestyle, whereas depression is just something that happened to you. It's just genetic, it's just bad luck, you know, it's an environment, whatever, but it's nothing to do with how you live your life or the choices that you make. And he said that's consistent throughout the whole welfare state. It's all about stripping people from their autonomy, of their volition, of their moral core, you know, by supposedly about liberating them, you know, sort of non-stigmatization, non-judgment, you know, but the net effect is actually that you take from them the very thing that they have that can help them through it, which is a sense of moral responsibility for their situation.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of what Peterson talks about, doesn't it? Like, people have no responsibility for themselves. We infantilize. I think that's what we're doing, isn't it? I think that's what Hitchens is talking about as well, is that we're making, you know, we can't listen to things that upset us, we can't take responsibility for things that make us feel unhappy. Just the whole, I don't even know where it's come from, that this is a thing now, that you know, just going back to that school thing, the fact that those girls talking in assembly and me saying, please, could you be quiet? It's not their fault that I told them to be quiet. It's my fault. You know, it's not their fault. It's me being intimidating. It's not their fault for talking. And I think very quickly, because it's nearly 11 o'clock here, but in this country with the gender recognition certificate, there are two things that are exempt from being, so you cannot transition into a peerage. So you can't suddenly overtake your brother by becoming a boy. And Church of England are exempt on the matter of conscience.
In what sense exempt?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I've been trying to read about it today, but I've been a bit busy. But it's so I think that might be that if a trans woman came into the church and wanted a church wedding marrying a man, so actually that person, that Church of England vicar, would think that was two men getting married, that he in good conscience could choose not to marry them. Maybe, I don't know.
Right.
But it's interesting that both those things are about the House of Lords.
Right.
So they've built into any legal thing that they are exempt.
Yeah. Well, when you first said that, the reason I laughed when you said you couldn't transition into periods was I thought you were talking about somebody who wanted to say, actually, I'm a lord in a serf's body, and I think I should be given a knighthood because that's I identify with. And yeah, I actually thought you meant that because you know it's coming.
Is wealthy people, they're not stupid about protecting their money.
No.
You know, it's just, I just find it quite interesting that there's such a hypocrisy. It's all right for a man to transition into a woman just by sticking on a dress. That's all he'll need to do to self-ID as a woman and go in a woman's toilet and a woman's changing room. It's all right for him to do that and ask lowly women to put up with a penis in our faces. But for God's sake, don't let that woman have her hands on the peerage of, I can't remember what it is, there's another term, but I think it's specifically for titles. I think recently there was someone who died and the person who inherited was seven people removed, like seven cousins removed, because there were no males. So his own daughter got nothing. And then somebody who lived in Spain or something, who was like his seventh cousin, was the first male heir to whatever that was, like some title. So yeah, no women can transition into peerages.
Wow.
If this is going to go on, because Stonewall and the big LGBT groups, they are very, very well funded. I don't know where the big bucks are coming from, but... it's quite frightening how well funded they are. I don't know if you're on Twitter, but Alison Moyet the other day just said that she wasn't cis, and then she got absolutely annihilated just for saying, I'm not cis, I don't need to use the word cis. J.K. Rowling liked something that somebody had tweeted, and people went absolutely nuts for days and called her an evil turf.
Wow. Be careful what you like.
Yeah. I'm banned from Twitter at the moment.
Oh. For 7 days. 7 days?
Yeah. Gosh. Because I said that trans women are men. What else did I say? And I talked about the crime stats that don't change. And obviously I'm a hateful person for saying those things.
Yeah, it makes me want to try an experiment and see how hard it is to get banned, because obviously you're already under the microscope, so, but anyway, I probably shouldn't do that, but we'll just see how long it takes.
Well, I don't think, I've got lots of friends that have been permanently banned, including their IP address, and these are only women sticking up for women. None of us are genuinely transphobic. I don't hate trans people, I just don't really think they exist.
Well, it means fear anyway, that's the funny thing. People always forget that. Phobia means fear, it's got nothing to do with hatred.
Well, I guess I could be transphobic then, because I'm quite fearful of... Actually, no, I'm intuitively risk averse, so I don't want... You know, we divide by sex for a reason. So... Anyway, my husband is at my office door with a glass of Prosecco.
That's nice.